Welcome to the Pediatric and Developmental Pathology Podcast, where you'll hear about the authors and articles featured in the journal Pediatric and Developmental Pathology. I'm Dr. Mike Arnold of Children's Hospital Colorado and the University of Colorado on the Anschutz Medical Campus.
And I'm Dr. Jason Wang, pediatric pathologist at Cook Children's Medical Center, based in Fort Worth, Texas.
And today we're going to be speaking with the authors of an article in Pediatric and Developmental Pathology titled Eosinophilic Gastrointestinal Disorders, A New Path. This article deals with the nomenclature we should use when we make diagnoses that involve eosinophils throughout the gastrointestinal tract. So let's meet our guests.
I'm Margaret Collins. I'm a pediatric pathologist at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center and one of the central review pathologists for the Consortium for Eosinophilic Gastrointestinal Researchers.
Hi, my name is Nicole Arva, and I am a pediatric pathologist of Nationwide Children's Hospital, Ohio State University.
I have a particular interest in pediatric gastrointestinal diseases, and I joined the Central Pathology Reviewer Group for SIGR, along with Dr. Collins and Maria Plenova.
I'm Maria Plenova. I'm an adult GI pathologist at the University of Utah. I was very thankful that Margaret invited me to join SIGR, and now I'm part of this wonderful group that studies eosinophilic diseases of the gut.
I'd love to start the podcast off by hearing a little bit about our guests. Tell us briefly a little bit about how you got interested in pathology and pediatric gastrointestinal diseases.
I went to medical school at Georgetown, and while I was there, they began a program called a student intern program that was at very few places at the time, and now is more prevalent than when I was in medical school. But it's a program in which students spend a year in pathology between their second and their third years of medical school, functioning as a house officer in pathology. And when it was announced, I went to the chairperson and I said I was interested in doing it because no matter what I went into, a year in pathology would be helpful to me. But I did not want to be a pathologist. And the chairperson said, "That's okay, Margaret. We're not trying to make a pathologist out of you." But slowly during the year, and almost grudgingly, I began to realize that so much of what is done clinically is done because of what the pathologist says, both in anatomic pathology as well as in clinical pathology. So we're the most important doctors that patients never meet. And we are not at the bedside, but what happens at the bedside is largely determined by our input. So during the course of the year, I spent 3 months at Children's Hospital National Medical Center, as it was called at that time. And I loved it. Ramachandra was the head of pathology there at the time. And not only was it interesting, but it was fun. And so I decided to keep an open mind when I went through the rest of medical school. And honestly, I would be a surgeon, except that I know I would have been very mentally challenged by the lack of sleep that goes with being in surgery, especially in those days. Then my next choice was pathology, and my first choice there was pediatric pathology because I really liked it. So I continued training in that. And when you're in pediatric pathology, over the years, the volume of GI path has increased an awful lot. So you almost can't be not interested in GI pathology and be a pediatric pathologist. And it sounds like the start of a joke, but it's true. An allergist, a gastroenterologist, and a pathologist walked into Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center and began working on this new disease that we, two of us, had seen a little bit before and was becoming more common here. And the Cincinnati Center for Eosinophilic Disorders was formed, and we're still trying to figure out why there are so many eosinophils in the gut in some children.
That's very cool. And I really appreciate the part of your story that you were just trying to learn more about the lab because you recognized it was going to impact whatever you did. And I wish more trainees understood that and got a chance to spend some time in pathology.
Agreed.
For me, pathology gave me the opportunity to combine clinical practice with research. So during my oncology clerkship in medical school, I realized that without understanding the mechanisms of diseases, we cannot come up with good therapeutic modalities for our patients. And this pushed me to actually pursue additional training, doing a PhD program in cancer biology. And this is when I started to work with cells and tissues and look under the microscope. And this actually started my interest in pathology. It is the field that unveils the etiology of diseases. And this is really important to develop appropriate therapeutic strategies for the patients. I chose to further specialize in pediatric pathology because it is a very broad field. We are not organ restricted, so we see a lot of pathology from all organ systems. And this is somehow challenging because you have to be very knowledgeable and read a lot and be up to date to what's happening in every single organ in the body. On the other hand, changing the lives of very young patients is very fulfilling. And that's another reason why I decided to pursue pediatric pathology. And as Dr. Collins says, it's impossible not to like GI pathology since the volume is so great in these specific diseases.
My path to pathology was slightly different. I participated in infectious disease research on noroviruses throughout high school and college. And so I felt comfortable with a microscope because you had to use that in the lab. And I was really interested in infectious disease when I went to the MSTP program at Hopkins, the medical scientist training program. And there, you know, I was really, or at least I thought I was going to do infectious disease. But the road to infectious disease does lie through medicine internship and, fellowship in infectious disease. And, you know, my eyes were a little bit opened in discussions with infectious disease fellows about their normal workload, daily, you know, duties and so on. But as a student, I was fortunate enough to be able to participate in the pathology rotation, which at Hopkins is 2 months long. So a sub-internship essentially, which was phenomenal. And there we functioned as essentially half an intern. So we did as many cases in autopsy or half as many cases in autopsy as the interns did. And then we participated in surgical pathology, sign out and prepared cases. So it was a fabulous, fabulous rotation, which really taught, you know, pathology at depth to the medical students. And I thought it was great, but I wasn't yet set on pathology as my future. And then the very next rotation was through internal medicine, and it was internal medicine sub-I. And at the time, I suppose it put me off a little bit that we had to, round on 5 patients for 3 hours, whereas in pathology, we were writing, you know, reports on our own and just had the attending, you know, go through the slides with us and correct anything that needed to be corrected. But, you know, we did the work. And so it was a very different experience where in pathology, we're given as students a lot of responsibility, which lent
that experience to a lot of learning in, you know, investigative learning on your own part to be able to come up with the appropriate diagnosis for the tissues that you saw and so on. And I think that that's probably the best way to learn, at least for me. And so at that point, I thought, well, maybe I should rethink what I'm going to be doing. And so, and then, of course, I went to do my PhD as part of the MSDP program. And when I came back to surgery. And that was a fairly grueling rotation, as you can imagine. when the surgeons found out that I was considering pathology as a future career, they would send me down to the pathology suite with the specimen. And I just had that kind of an epiphany moment. You know, it's like, the angels were singing and, you know, I was home. I felt that feeling that I am home when I walked through the pathology doors. And so, and that sealed it for me. So I did not look back. I went and matched in pathology residency at the University of Michigan. And of course, you know, you come in with open eyes, you know, trying to see what speaks to you the most. And the two subspecialties in pathology that were the most interesting to me were hematopathology and GI pathology. And I really have to thank the GI attendings at Michigan because they made things so fun, so easy and easygoing and always, you know, joking and having this very light atmosphere that it was impossible not to love GI path. And so, and that's how I became a GI pathologist. I still do a bit of hematopathology when it comes through my desk, because there's a lot of hematopathology in GI pathology. There's that intersection. But I am a card-carrying GI pathologist now. So that's my path.
Can you tell us a little bit about the background of the groups that are working on eosinophilic gastrointestinal diseases?
Well, the one group that unites the three of us is the Consortium for Eosinophilic Gastrointestinal Researchers, or CGER, that is funded by a U54 NIH grant. And currently there are 16 centers in the United States. Only in the United States are there participants in CGER. And it began because the people working in the field realized very acutely that although we were making progress in terms of understanding some aspects of the diseases, none of us had a very large patient population to draw from. That's especially true for the non-eosinophilic esophagitis aegids, and that we would likely accelerate and potentially improve our abilities to discover new aspects about those diseases by coming together as one group. Certainly continuing independent research in, as individuals and in the varying institutions, and that has continued. Coming together as a group for particular purposes. So one of the studies that's performed by CGER is an observational study. Patients are enrolled, they are cared for by the standard of care at each institution, and their biopsies are read at the institution, but then are reviewed centrally by the central review pathologists. And we're having several studies that are correlating those findings, clinical findings, with pathology findings. Also, clinical trials are required as part of the U54 funding mechanism. So we have a paper concerning the use of diet to treat eosinophilic esophagitis that again includes data generated by the central review by the pathologists forming the pathology core. So that's the main group, I would say, in the United States that is pursuing studies in eosinophilic esophagitis and non-EoE eosinophilic gastrointestinal disorders. There is a group in Europe that has formed called EURIOS that also is studying EGIDs, and they're making very nice progress in some of their studies as well.
And all I can say is that I joined this SIGAR group in 2018, and what I do as a central pathology reviewer, I review scan slides of esophageal, gastric, colonic biopsies, and we use kind of like a scoring system for each of these sites, and we assess not only the peak eosinophil count, but also other features that other histologic features that can be seen in EGIDs. And as Dr. Collins already mentioned, multiple publications of high impact came out from the group. Some are related to histology, some are related to diet.
Good for you, Nicole, for for adding that. And we found, for example, with eosinophilic gastritis, that some of the features that we are scoring histologically correlate with the genes that are dysregulated in that disease. That makes a nice correlation that potentially we'll be able to say when we see certain of those features, we know that such and such a gene is upregulated or downregulated, and if there are drugs available that treat abnormalities of gene X, then that would be an example of how we would be facilitating personalized medicine, which is certainly a goal everybody's got these days.
I would add that on the same trend of thoughts, the paper regarding eosinophilic colitis that came out showing that it's a completely distinct entity with a different molecular profile, different from eosinophilic esophagitis or gastritis, and also different from inflammatory bowel disease. And I think there is still a lot of work to do on this eosinophilic colitis given these facts, because I am not sure the same drugs will work in the treatment of eosinophilic colitis since a different etiology is involved.
Sometimes you find certain histologic features that are not the most obvious, like eosinophilic numbers or something like that, that actually correlate to interesting gene expression profiles and so on. I just find that so fascinating. I think it's pretty amazing. So it's really neat to be a part of the group that can study these at a volume, you know, as opposed to, you know, single sort of patient numbers. So I think that's the strength of the consortium, to be able to provide this sort of available volume for study of these rather under-recognized diseases, I think.
Eosinophilic gastrointestinal disease is a pretty broad term. Describe really briefly some of the etiologies of the various conditions that fall under that umbrella.
I would say that most likely they are related to an allergic reaction, although the allergic response doesn't seem to be as prominent in eosinophilic colitis as in other EGIDs.
And I think that there's a complex interplay between, you know, the eosinophils, which we sort of take as maybe end mediators of damage, but they are controlled by a whole slew of other cellular types and you know, chemotactic, you know, factors and so on. I think in some studies it was shown that some drugs that target eosinophils don't necessarily alleviate the symptoms, and that maybe because there are other, you know, cell types like T cells and so on that are involved in these very, very complex pathways. And I think currently we don't yet know enough to unravel all of those. And so the work, you know, continues, of course. And it's not as simple as just the numbers of EOs or just, you know, how they're organized in the tissue and where they sit in the tissue. I think it's going to be quite some time before we unravel all of those pathways.
What I find interesting is the fact that some of the other histologic features still persist despite decrease in the number of eosinophils after treatment, showing in fact what Maria just mentioned, that eosinophils are not the only offenders in these diseases. Some other cellular components, maybe T cells or mast cells, are also involved.
One of the conditions that's associated with EGID, or at least associated with excess eosinophils in the GI tract, is hypereosinophilic syndrome, which may have a malignant form. The one I worry about the most is parasitic infestation. I think it's easy to miss unless there are really large numbers of parasites in the gut. It's easy for them to scoot out of the way when the endoscope is or colonoscope is being introduced. And it seems that the stool for ONP is not the most sensitive or specific. Maybe it's specific, but it's not as sensitive a lab test as we would like it to be. And I wish there was something expressed by most that we could form an antibody to and test for, either in stool or blood or whatever, because and again, as Nicole has pointed out, we have data now that eosinophilic colitis, what looks like eosinophilic colitis under the microscope, seems to be a different disease from upper tract eosinophilic diseases, which makes it more imperative that we find ways of accurately testing for substances that can cause eosinophilia in the colon.
Can I ask one quick clarification about the consortium? Does it include both adult and pediatric patients?
Yes, it does. And I think that's really a strength of it. Another strength is the collegiality among the investigators. Outside groups have commented on the degree of collegiality that they find in this consortium that is very nice to work with.
Let's talk a little bit about the article that you published in Pediatric and Developmental Pathology. And it's really focused on nomenclature. Talk to us a little bit about how the nomenclature varies by anatomic site in different types of eosinophilic gastrointestinal diseases.
Well, the impetus for the study that is referenced and reported in PGP actually began with pathologists because we are so aware of our need to use terminology that is both clinically meaningful as well as well-defined. And the term eosinophilic gastroenteritis really began to be used more commonly in the early, mid-20th century, based a lot on resections of people who had small bowel obstruction. And those resections showed a lot of eosinophilia in the mucosa, in the submucosa, muscularis, sometimes out in the serosa, but that's usually associated with ascites. And the term that was used to describe that small bowel disorder was eosinophilic gastroenteritis. And for many years, it was used just that way. But now that we have endoscopies that are more sophisticated than in the past, including video capsule endoscopies and so on, and We know that eosinophils are normal eosinophils, non-neoplastic eosinophils are exquisitely sensitive to steroids. And we have better imaging than we had in the past as well. We rarely see small bowel resections anymore for people who have obstruction due to eosinophilic infiltrates in their gut. It's found by imaging or a mucosal biopsy. Steroids are given, the bowel reverts to normal radiographically, and there's no more obstruction. And so, but the term continued to be used, and as part of the study that we published, we found that even among the people who were part of that study, the 91 people who have experience in the field and who represented five continents, among them there was there were 34% said they used that term to mean excess eosinophil inflammation, predominant eosinophil inflammation in both the stomach and the small bowel. The next highest use was 14% said they used it for the small bowel only, I think it was. And then the rest was all over the place. People were using it to mean only gastric inflammation or only small bowel inflammation or inflammation throughout the GI tract. So we understood that we needed to begin to come up with a more specific nomenclature, one that had more specific meaning than using the term eosinophilic gastroenteritis. And actually that became a project for SEEGER. So we used the infrastructure of SEEGER to begin that study and then built on that.
In the paper, you described the more specific terms to be used. Would you recommend for a practicing community pathologist or even an academic pathologist that we make the transition in the diagnoses, or do you typically put them in the comment? How do you incorporate these diagnostic terms?
Diagnostic line, absolutely the diagnostic line, yeah. We've recommended that eosinophilic gastroenteritis, it has been used in so many different ways that it's no longer meaningful, and the term really should not be used any longer. If it is, it should be used to designate only eosinophilic gastritis and eosinophilic duodenitis or enteritis. The terms that we recommend are specific, eosinophilic gastritis, designated EOG, eosinophilic enteritis, designated EON, and eosinophilic colitis, designated EOC, as part of a clinical report. Eosinophilic esophagitis, designated EOE, stays the same as EOE. You could get more specific if you wanted to, and say eosinophilic duodenitis or eosinophilic jejunitis or eosinophilic ileitis. I think that would be a good thing to do clinically. It's not necessary, but I think that clinicians would actually find that quite helpful if they had done both an upper and a lower GI evaluation, and they would prefer, even if you say eosinophilic enteritis, you could put in parenthesis eosinophilic ileitis so that the clinician would know it at a glance where the eos had been found in the small bowel.
Yeah, I think it's important to have a uniform way of signing out these cases for future studies, I guess, if you are to identify patients, if you do retrospective studies. That's why I think we recommend that pathologists will adopt this new nomenclature.
And I would say that we still have to use a little bit of caution when we use these terms, right? Because we need to make sure that other reasons for eosinophilia have been excluded. Both clinically and histologically. The, you know, prime example is eosinophilic esophagitis. You know, I always think about it in terms of a clinical pathologic correlation, you know, because histologically we do see mimics you know, features that we see in eosinophilic esophagitis in other entities. So we always have to pay attention and make sure that we're looking at the clinical history, what tests have been done, you know, look for any sort of pill remnants and you know, parasitic, you know, forms and so on. So I think the same level of caution has to be exercised when we are looking at other sites in the gut. But I agree that absolutely that a unified and very defined set of terms is going to be very helpful going forward, because it is, you know, difficult to tease what the patients actually had in the different studies previously, because the terms have been used a bit interchangeably, you know, and it's hard to know what they actually meant. That's my additional 2 cents.
Oh, very important 2 cents, Maria. Thank you for bringing that up. And actually in the article, we acknowledge that situation. There are abundant consensus recommendations for eosinophilic esophagitis now. In the January issue, volume 78, issue 1 of the Journal of Pediatric Gastroenterology and Nutrition, there is now a paper that reports the recommendations and guidelines that the European and North American societies for pediatric gastroenterology and nutrition came up with. And for anyone who's interested in the field, having a read of that article would be very helpful.
I think the most challenging aspect of these disorders is determining when you have sufficient histologic evidence to make that classification, specifically peak eosinophil count. What is too much in, say, the left colon and the right colon? Can you give some guidance about what thresholds pathologists should apply to make these diagnoses?
So for eosinophilic esophagitis, is already established that 15 eosinophils per high power field is kind of the threshold when we start thinking about UAE. But there are guidelines, published guidelines for eosinophilic gastritis and enteritis and colitis. For the small and large bowel, is usually double the number of normal eosinophils. It's a little bit more difficult in the small and large bowel, because in the lamina propria of these organs, we normally have eosinophils, whereas eosinophils in the esophagus are pathologic, regardless of the number. And for the small bowel and large bowel, the threshold is about 2 times the normal. And there are published papers that came up with the normal number of eosinophils. So when we see double those numbers, then we consider EGIDs.
I remember reading a while back, and I don't know if it still holds, about regional variation and sort of normal eosinophil counts. I remember seeing, like, regionally within the United States, like certain areas of the country having sort of finding a few more eosinophils than a different part of the country. Is that still the teaching and the evidence that y'all see?
There was one study quite a while ago that in the colon showed that people in the southern part of the United States had higher counts in their colon biopsies than people in the northern part of the United States. To my knowledge, that was never shown again in any other study in the US. There have been 2 studies of children in Europe, multiple sites in Europe, and each of those studies showed some difference in the number of eosinophils according to geography. One of them was a higher number in London compared to a few other cities in Europe and maybe in Israel. I'm not well-versed in those two studies in particular. But so there have been more recently some additional studies, not in the U.S., that suggest that there is a variation according to geography.
But I suppose if you're using, you know, two-fold differences, slight variations wouldn't really make a difference in when you're going to diagnose the disease versus not.
Yeah, I think so. And there is now a publication that supports using approximately two times the normal threshold value of eosinophils for a diagnosis of eosinophilic duodenitis based on the genetic analysis that was done in that study.
Do you have any tips for young pathologists, residents, trainees, new attendings about the publication process? Because for me personally, I find sitting down and writing not the easiest task. Would you happen to have a short tip for anyone that's trying to be more productive?
For me, it's hard to start, but once I start, it's getting easier. So I think, passing that barrier, it's important.
I think that's true for a lot of pathologists. We tend to be people who don't publish as much as other people do. One thing that is very helpful is to work with and in a productive group. If it's possible to create a place for yourself in a group that publishes regularly, you'll find that you find the time, you make the time, you do it. And it might start out that you're editing what other people are doing, but it becomes a habit. And that's really what it is. It's developing the habit of writing. It could begin too with just absolutely sticking to a half an hour a day writing. Of course, you can't do it when you're, on Frozens. It has to be when you're not going to be pulled in seven different directions, because then you'll just get frustrated. But in the weeks that you will not have that kind of a demand on your time, just set aside that time and do it. It will become a habit. And I think that's one of the most important aspects of becoming a publisher, just make a habit out of it.
Margaret does suggest very, very good strategy, or strategies rather. I think being part of a productive group is definitely helpful, because it just makes you strive to belong, right? And there are other people that help in the process and put their thoughts forward. But I do think it's very difficult to tear yourself away from the fun of the slides and really sit down and put your thoughts about a subject on paper or screen or whatever, because there's always more fun things to do, with slides or teaching or whatever. So from that perspective, I think discipline is probably the best, but who has that? I don't know if I do.
This has been great. I really appreciate your contribution to pediatric and developmental pathology. And I think harmonizing our nomenclature is probably one of the most useful things we can do for communicating with our clinicians and setting ourselves up to do research. So thank you very much for speaking with us about your publication.
Yes, I second that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This is very helpful to our efforts.
Awesome.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Yes, thank you very much. This is the first time I'm doing this, so I had a lot of fun.
The Pediatric and Developmental Pathology podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only and is not medical advice. Any opinions expressed are solely those of our guests and hosts and may not represent Pediatric and Developmental Pathology, the Society for Pediatric Pathology, or the Pediatric Pathology Society. Thanks for listening to the Pediatric and Developmental Pathology Podcast.